See, you were tilting your head side to side. You can't help but do it. It's just, I think it's genetic. There's something about it. You have to do it when you hear that. And I'd frankly rather be listening to the song than talking. Alas, it is my job to talk at you. This is The Minefield. Welcome aboard. We will try to negotiate the ethical dilemmas of modern life, and it doesn't get much more modern, I suppose, or much more symbolic of the modern condition than what we are about to talk about today. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my tweeting co-host.
Oh, nice one. Well, you see, social media does seem just about inescapable these days, doesn't it? I mean, our lives are saturated with tweets and likes and hashtags and memes and GIFs. But it seems to me that this isn't just ephemera. It's not just, you know, digital trinkets that are kind of littering our screens. Platforms like Facebook and Google and Twitter are now the dominant forms of distribution of news content, which means that even news organizations like the ABC have to report on social media trends and broadcast Twitter streams and even tailor their news content to appease that elusive Facebook algorithm. Like I said, social media is almost inescapable these days for most of us, except for you, Waleed. You're one of these kind of rare public figures that's studiously eluded being sucked in by the beast. How have you done it? I mean, why are you not on Twitter?
Well, before I answer that, why are you asking? And why does everybody ask me? I don't understand why this is of any interest to any. I mean, I'm not private about it, but I just don't get why anyone cares.
I think that what that probably reflects, though, is just the fact that this is part of our ambience. I mean, it's just the atmosphere that we're breathing now. And so to have someone like you who's so visible and yet isn't visible in this other way that we expect, it just raises certain, I don't know, curiosities.
All right, well, let's buy an extra half an hour from the network so that I can get through all of my reasons for not being on social media. It begins with the realization that the world does not need more of me talking at it. Right, I do a radio show, I do a TV show, I write columns. That's enough. I don't think anyone needs anymore.
Eddie Maguire, I think you're sometimes called.
Well, no, but you just told me I'm not on social media, so I clearly can't be everywhere, Scott.
Right,
come on, be consistent within your own argument. I should have checked whether Eddie Maguire's actually on social media before I made that comment. Anyway, that's sort of the trivial end of it. The other end of it is I've always had a deep ethical objection to social media. Ethical maybe is the wrong word. Philosophical objection is probably better. And it's for many reasons. One, I believe that social media does not live up to its promise of being a mere complement to human interaction. That is something that enhances connectivity and enhances human interaction. I believe, through my observation of friends, that it actively displaces human interaction, and it thereby does it, given the nature of it, it does it in a very anemic way, so that what we get is actually an anemic version of friendship, an anemic version of engagement that is really, really shallow in place of that which is deep and richly human. So that's one of my objections. My other objection is that I think the inherent logic of it, the inherent grammar of social media is such that conversations can only ever pretend to be anything other than shallow. So that arguments, ideas that are tossed around are never really tossed around, because all of those arguments are turned from engagement into performance. And so every aspect of our lives suddenly, whether it be argument over political issue or social issue, pop culture, whatever it is, or it just be that sort of endless tweeting of meals that you're eating or whatever it might be, all of that, the thing that unites all of that experience is that it is an experience of performance. So we turn our entire social intercourse into something that is to be reviewed. We are always reviewers. Everything is worthy of review. We consider ourselves worthy reviewers, and we are trying to create some kind of public persona of ourselves perpetually. That means that we are in what I, as someone who broadcasts regularly and therefore performs regularly, regard as an unhealthy mode of being. I think if you are doing a broadcast or something like that, it's a really good thing to do that and then not do it for long periods of time, because it's not a mode of human behavior or a mode of human existence that I think is healthy. And we are gradually turning our entire society into a performance society. And that brings in all sorts of critiques you'd be familiar with, to do with narcissism and so on. But, you know, That's where I would start. If you want, I can go into Bourdieu and I can talk habitus and I can talk about the ethos that this creates across society. And maybe I'll do that a bit later in the show. But I think I've been crapping on long enough.
Oh, Waleed, you're talking my language. Look, you have actually put me in an unbelievably difficult situation here. Because on the one hand, everything you just said, not only would I agree with, but those are all causes that are worth dying in the ditch for. And I want to come back to a couple of them in a second.
And yet you're living in the ditch of Twitter, Scott. That's what you're doing.
Well, I do it as part of my conditions of employment. But hang on. I can't believe this. I have to defend social media to Waleed Ali. I mean, I'm going to have to take a shower after this program, seriously.
I'm just going to give people a chance to go over to their TAC stereos and press play and record so that they can capture this moment.
One of the things that I think we do have to wrestle with is which actually came first. Was there a kind of debasement of the habits of civility? Was there a collapse of our capacity for public discourse? But also, you know, the abilities to reason with one another, to persuade one another. And one of the things that we've talked about this on this program so many times has been that the art of persuasion has been lost, not just from politicians, but also within the public more generally. So what we do is we appeal to our tribes. And by appealing to our tribes, we have no other recourse but increasingly bastardized, bolderized language. So there's no desire, if you like, to be able to reason, to exercise virtues such as empathy and interpersonal identification. Let me lay that... Which came first? Was it that, or has technology essentially perverted? Has it brought out the worst in us, or did it kind of strip us? That's a question I'd love to put to you in a little bit. First, however, I've been thinking quite a lot. Okay, if I didn't do what I did, if I wasn't responsible primarily for an ABC Twitter account, would I ever want to see Twitter again? Would I close my account and never, ever log on? And it just struck me the other day, Waleed, that, you know, there are certain things that I probably would miss. And I think this probably comes down to what you use Twitter for. If things like Twitter are an expression of social interaction, if it's an expression of conversation, then I think you're absolutely right. It is making us worse. It's making our dialogue and our capacity to understand one another worse.
Well, but worse than that, while convincing us that we're actually getting better at it.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And this is where the illusion of interpersonal connection is a kind of ersatz placebo. It's actually, it's convincing us that we are actually interacting with one another, whereas we are doing nothing of the like. But at the same time, you know, one of the things, I mean, that's not what I use Twitter for. I don't use Twitter to be in conversation with people. I use it because it lands you in the middle of narratives that otherwise it would take far too long to get your head around. In other words, it's a kind of signpost. It points you in a direction. It lets you know about certain things that are going on. Now, here's where I'd like to throw the question back to you. If Twitter can be used as kind of like a news feed, you know, like, you know, those little strings of tape that we used to see in sort of 1920s, 1930s news feed movies. If some of us use Twitter like that, if we use it as a way of gaining awareness of certain things that are going on in the world, that, it seems to me, raises a different ethical dilemma. I mean, Susan Sontag in the late 1970s raised concerns about photography being something that, you know, initially photographs convey their meaning powerfully. But she said that photographs are ethically fragile. They'll excite. They'll whip up a kind of moral sentiment. But then the meaning evaporates so quickly because photographs can't garner commitment and dedication. I do wonder, Waleed, do you see the same thing going on with things like Twitter and Facebook? They raise awareness, but they can't sustain awareness.
Kony 2012, Scott. Kony 2012.
Yes, exactly.
There's your answer. Yeah.
But also, also Palestine, also Syria, also Black Lives Matter, also All Lives Matter. Also, you know, this is the kind of the witness-bearing dimension of social media, but there's not much social or political commitment that then comes in behind.
The one thing I would say in social media's defense, the one thing I would accept is that it does give a voice to people who otherwise would be locked outside of the mainstream conversation because mainstream media does not reflect their perspectives. That's what the Black Lives Matter thing was about, and there are umpteen examples of that. Right, feminism is another example where that sort of discourse has grown in power because of it. On the flip side, a cause like ISIS has also grown in power for precisely the same reason. So there are swings and roundabouts to all that. I accept that is true. What bothers me about it, though, the inherent logic of the medium is such that all, and I think we've spoken about this before in the context of images, all of those different elements of our newsfeed are more or less equal.
Yeah.
And they reach us in equal and identical packaging.
And they have to compete then with the Kardashians and with whatever's going on Channel 10 or whatever else.
Exactly, which is the whole infobesity thing that we've spoken about before. So I do have a problem with that. I think this idea that we could all treat it as a newsfeed and then that would be fine, no. Because if everyone did that, there would be no news to feed. It wouldn't work that way. The whole thing is it works on the basis of interaction and engagement. And that annoys me because I think when people talk about interaction and engagement, what we're actually talking about is an apology for interaction and engagement. It's kind of this, like I say, an anemic version of it. The other element of it, which I do want to talk about with our guest soon, is the idea of the creation of cultures of abuse. So where you have people who gather together, and because Twitter, and not just Twitter, Facebook as well, all those social media platforms, because they are a performance, what they ask us to do ultimately, or implicitly, is to present a particular version, a particular identity of ourselves to the world. And that might be around the fact that we're feminists, or around the fact that we're race activists, or around the fact that we're right-wing or left-wing or whatever it is. And as we do that, we then become increasingly locked into those particular identities. Because, again, we're not being people here, we're being performers. And as a result of being performers in that way, we become so hardened in our expression of those aspects of our identity that all we can really do is defend those barricades that we've set up. And we do that usually by hurling abuse at those who somehow challenge or offend those particular barricades that we've set up. And we have to abuse because that is the shortest path towards the kind of performance that we are trying to give to the world. I think that's a real problem. And I would be interested in your thoughts on that, but also the thoughts of our guest, who will be joining us very, very soon. This is The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website. Search for RN The Minefield if you want to find us. Alternatively, oh, this is the most richly ironic reset I'll ever do, tweet us at RN The Minefield. That's a Twitter handle. Apparently, you can communicate with us that way.
Okay, here it is. Bit soup. It's like alphabet soup, but ones and zeros instead of the letters. Because it's binary, you know, binary is just ones and zeros.
Yeah, I know what binary is. Jesus Christ, I memorized the hexadecimal times tables when I was 14 writing machine code. Okay? Ask me what 9 times F is. It's 75. I do not need you telling me what binary is, just like I don't need you thinking about soup or taking pictures of it. I need you thinking about apps, software, websites. This is Silicon Valley, all right? Not Paris, Texas. It's where Campbell's Soup is.
Oh, man, there's no way that I can't find that funny. That's a clip from the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley, the home of Facebook and Google and Twitter, and that's where we want to take the conversation now. Alistair Campbell is the strategy lead at the digital strategy agency Squareware. Not exactly the most likely person to be criticizing tech companies, but he's got some real concerns about their governing ethics and the toxic work environments that they're cultivating. So, Alistair, explain yourself.
Sorry, Matt, I didn't hear a word you said. I'm still stuck on Flevent.
That's very good. I'm a
I should point out, Scott also gave you a promotion to being Tony Blair's spin doctor for a moment there. It's Alistair Cameron, of course.
Did I say Campbell?
It's, I understand when you have a name like that that's been lodged in your brain for so many years.
Sorry.
That's all right. That is okay. So, Scott, what would you? Where would you like me to start?
Okay. Let me go back to square one. One of the conversations that Waleed and I have been having for a while is that a vocation is bound up with the past. A vocation is bound up to some extent with tradition. In other words, you're inheriting something, you're passing something on. Is one of the issues with tech companies, you know, it's almost like they are, it's a kind of raised earth policy. They are inventing things from scratch. And so there's no ethos, there's no past. All they have to do is to charge towards the future. Is that one of the issues that's kind of breeding this sense of toxicity?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a difficult one to answer. It's interesting that a lot of this stuff happens in San Francisco. If you go back far enough, you've got the San Francisco gold rush of the 1800s. And if you sort of visualize that as best as you can, all these people are just rushing for the location with the opportunity of getting rich quick. And there is a morality and ethics sort of goes out the door because there's just a lot of money there. There's a lot of gold hiding in them there hills, you know. And I think there has been a pairing back of the quality of thinking that's gone on in favour of some pretty brutal basics, aggression, just a rush for the opportunity. And I think that's reflective of the fact that technology by its nature is moving and is advancing so quickly. But I think in some way we're overdue for a reflective moment. Mm. And it would have been nice if the 2000 bubble bursting, the tech bubble bursting, would have given us that opportunity. And arguably it did for some. But I still feel like there is such a mad rush for riches. And there is such an approval or a pat on the back for those who demonstrate the greatest levels of aggression and determination. But there's a whole lot of nuance that's being left behind. And the casualty is human.
Is it more than just a rush for riches, though? Is there actually a commitment to a broader ethic that just believes in the perfectibility of the world through technology? Or is that just a legitimizing philosophy? Because when I hang out with tech people, which I don't do that often, but when I do, I'm struck by how fervently they seem to believe they are actually making the world a better place because they can code.
Yep. I think that's true. I think that's true to an extent. I don't think that's everyone, but I certainly think that, oh, now you're going to ask me about philosophical underpinnings for a thought like that, and I'm sure there's a really good one out there somewhere. And I dare say one of the things that's probably very real about here, and I've written a piece which is on the ABC site around the influence of one philosopher, Ayn Rand, in this regard. And I think the reality is we can borrow interesting morsels of insight from one or other philosophy, but I wonder if the instincts are more basal than that. I wonder if the average guy is really thinking. I think so. I think for the most part it is. Some of the acolytes of her particular philosophy have gone and put her book covers on their Twitter avatars or something and inferred some allegiance to it. But I think at the end of the day, most of us are rushing so fast towards whatever we're trying to achieve, and we're justifying it only as much as we need to get away with, right, as far as ethical and philosophical underpinnings are concerned. The rest of it, I think, is potentially more of a base instinct than that.
And there is, in fact, I mean, if there is some value behind this, and this would really be getting right to the heart of someone like Ayn Rand's philosophy, it is that disruption as such is actually a positive value. And that if there are people that get left in the rubble behind, then they never deserve to be up with the rest of us in the first place. So there is it's almost a kind of technological or economic supremacism, isn't it? Those who are in front ought to be in front.
Yes. And that's where I think we have to stop and think very, very carefully. I don't want to be part of a philosophical movement that leaves the weaker ones behind. I think it's completely merciless. I think it's harsh. And I think we can do better than that. I think the challenge for us is to appreciate the value of disruption. Things are going to disrupt. Smart people show up. Investors love smart people who disrupt things. And who can argue that Uber, to use a contemporary example, is in many ways better than the traditional taxi system?
Well, taxi industry, I can argue.
The taxi industry can argue. Yeah, fair enough. But the exploration of how an Uber goes about what it does, how it confronts the current regulatory environment, the shoot now, apologize later approach, which is fairly broadly adopted across a number of these sort of key players, is highly questionable, and there is a casualty count, and the cries are rising.
And yet, I read a fascinating article by Umair Haque talking about Twitter and the fact that people are starting to abandon it. And he picks up this point, which I raised earlier in the program, of abuse, saying that part of the ethical vacuum that surrounds social media companies, the fact that they don't really care about the ethics of the product, just the commercialization of it, has meant that when they saw abuse culture arise, they didn't actually take it seriously. What do you make of that critique?
I've long wondered about that from the vantage point of someone helping others to build technology platforms. Okay, so Twitter is a platform, effectively. It's almost a carriage service, frankly. And you wonder about that, actually. That's a question right there.
Ah, like a legal question.
Yeah, when something gets as important, as so vital for communication, and if wrongly executed can hurt so many people, then it almost needs to be protected. It almost needs to be taken care of in a way that acknowledges that it's more than just a platform.
But that's interesting.
But for what it's worth, Twitter is a platform. It's from a branding perspective, from a how you go to market perspective, they're able to say, we provide the platform, but we're not the conversation that goes on the platform. And so this duty of care question is largely avoided for the most part. I don't hear really deep conversations around that. It's even hard if you're the police force to get in to get on the phone with Facebook. Until you've done it and you've figured out how to do it, you know, it's a challenge. So if there's abuse occurring on these platforms, the path to redress is very challenging. I've had my own experiences of it, and it's just incredibly frustrating. And I think it's because they just don't want to be positioned that way, because it's a no-win for the company.
Now, it seems to me that there is no way that a tech company or a successful business is going to listen to philosophical or ethical arguments until it begins to bite the bottom line. And that's one of the points I thought that Umair had raised quite nicely, is that this is actually having a kind of market effect. People are abandoning Twitter because who needs that kind of abuse? And then you've actually got the flip side that you raise in your article, Alistair, ex-employees leaving tech companies and then talking about the toxic environments that they've created, and that creates a kind of PR disaster. I mean, it does sort of leave you wondering, without some kind of ethical overhaul, without some injection of even basic civility or common decency, I mean, we are looking at a kind of market catastrophe, aren't we?
Look, we potentially are, but what is remarkable here is that the feedback loop is not very good.
Right.
Okay, so let's say that there are a whole ton of employees who are really not happy with the Amazons, the Ubers, the Apples, whatever company that you want to bring up. The feedback loop's not really all that good. We haven't galvanized, we haven't crowdsourced protest in such a way that those organizations are rigorously held to account. I don't immediately have the answer to that, but that's the logical place this conversation goes. How do you get enough people making the same point? How does it stick? Mm. And ultimately, the Ayn Rand response would be, let the market decide. The laissez-faire capitalist response is, let the market decide. But there is this element of mercilessness, of harshness to that. Yes, the market will ultimately decide, but there's going to be a lot of hurt people along the way. What do you do in the meantime?
All sorts of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Scott, I think it's quite charming to hear you place your faith in an Ayn Rand inspired solution.
Don't say that.
Well, look, that's just what you did, isn't
it? For the first time ever, it's almost like I was saying, look, forget philosophy for a second. Let's just talk about the effect of the market.
Well, is that the sad realization here? That actually seems to be, and you can take this well beyond technology, this is a broader social question, that this seems now to be the only ethical mechanism by which we can resolve controversies. If there was an ethical paradigm prior to the creation of these various digital platforms, then you'd have different digital platforms and you would resolve the problems that arise within them in a very different way. But we just don't seem to have the ethical, the moral language to do that anymore.
Well, I think there is a challenge here. There's an opportunity. There's always an opportunity, okay? We can even disrupt this. And I think this is the ultimate point that I'm making. Mm. We can create ethically run companies, right? We can invite another kind of CEO to step up. And so I'm working in a small company, SquareWeave. We build websites and so forth. But we are working towards a brand in part. I mean, we literally pitch ourselves as an organization that works for ethical type of outcomes, but we also follow through internally. So we are challenging each other to think ethically. And it starts with recycling, and it starts with those sorts of simple things. Mm. But it goes to very challenging questions about what customers will we work with, what clients will we work with, what clients won't we? What sort of legacy do we want to leave? What sort of internal culture do we want to create? And there's plenty of opportunity for all of us to be involved in that. Ultimately, create alternatives.
That would be a very interesting future to observe. Alistair, we are out of time, but it's been wonderful to have you in.
My pleasure. Thanks,
Alistair Cameron, strategy lead at the digital agency SquareWeave. Scott, we have just a few moments left. Have you got any reflections on what you've heard there from Alistair?
Look, I've always thought that good examples can be philosophically and ethically compelling. And it seems to me that if we're sick and tired of bad behavior on social media, we'll try exemplifying some good behavior.
Can you just do that, though? Because you can exemplify it, but if there isn't the moral language or grammar for people to see what the example is actually pointing to, where do you go?
Yeah, but see, this is where peer pressure and crowd movements isn't such a bad thing. I mean, goodness can in fact be contagious.
All right, we'll see. I look forward to examining your Twitter feed, Scott, and seeing just how contagious all the goodwill is and the goodness is. If you would like to abuse Scott, please do it by tweeting at RNTheMinefield. That's it.
You can also leave a much nicer comment on our website. Just search for us at RNTheMinefield.
See, it's ironic. I'd much rather see you abuse him, even though I'm against this whole abuse culture. I'm going to go and contemplate the manifestation of my own contradictions. In the meantime, have a great week. We'll see you in another week or so.
What is it with author Andy Griffiths and his bum? You'll discover on the Sunday Extra podcast when Andy tells all in The Year That Made Me. We look at tough times for whistleblowers, go back to the future for Back to the Future, and have a lively outsiders exchange on wealth, union chicanery and the torture of children. Yep, that sounds like Australian politics. Join me, Jonathan Green. You can stream or download the program at the RN website.